Talk given Friday, 6th January 1978. How far do we understand this Buddhist teaching of anatta? How far do we really understand it? I rather think it's a teaching which has been considerably misunderstood by the bulk of people throughout the centuries. As you know, the English word used for atta, the Pali form of the Sanskrit atma, has been translated as self. Now, in modern languages, particularly in modern languages, the word self has a meaning, a specific, empirical, matter-of-fact, practical meaning, which has extremely little relationship to the meaning of the word atma or atta. We must take that into account first. Next, we must take into account the fact that throughout the entire canon, the Buddhistic canon, there is no statement whatsoever, positive statement, to the effect that there is no atma or no atta. The Pali comes after Sanskrit in terms of time. And the word atma, as it occurs in pre-Buddhistic literature, is spoken of as the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the unsorrowing, the stainless, the utterly pure. And when the teacher used the term, and you find them particularly in the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya Upanishads, the teacher exhorts the disciple, it is this which should be sought and realized. The teacher also points out that the Atma is indescribable, inconceivable, unimaginable. It has no characteristics by which it could be recognized, meaning therefore that it is not a finite something, material or immaterial, limited and particular, which could be recognized by us through our senses, our perceptions. you will see at once that that word Atma, therefore, stands for what in philosophic terms we call the absolute, the infinite. If something is infinite, you can't search for it, because oneself, the empirical self, is contained within this infinite. That infinite wholly contains this finite thing. So what is the finite thing trying to search for? How will it recognize? You can recognize something else which is finite, which is limited, which is particular, which has characteristics, properties. But it is said of the Atma, it has no characteristics of which we can talk, of which we can think, and so forth. Its transcendent nature is presented in perhaps the most complete form, particularly in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. It comes in later Upanishads too. And this word Atma is not only equated with that other word Brahman, but is declared to be an absolute identity with Brahman. Bear that in mind. You may say, why two words then? Why not use just one word? Simply because the two words are the verbal answer, the sound, the symbolical sound made. The symbolical sound made by human beings to answer two questions which human beings ask. They ask, what is ultimate reality? Which is an objective intellectualist to be scientifically investigated question. The other question is, who am I? What is the meaning of myself? What is the real I? The question is asked partly out of ignorance of the fact that it is wrongly formulated, but that couldn't be helped. And partly because it is man's quest. Am I? And it is a subjective question, not an objective question. You look inwards to discover some imagined self, something real, one might say, something actual, permanent, etc., etc. It starts as two questions. The seeker starts with two questions. But as and when that seeking proceeds in the right way, the actual seeking ceases to be along this road or that road. The two roads merge into one road, and the answer is present, not found, not realized, not recognized, but the answer is present. Follow this very carefully, please. The two roads become one road. And it, this one rule is now a road in which there takes place in the seeker only one thing. A continuous growing transformation of his mode of awareness, of consciousness. Now bear this carefully in mind. In the ordinary way, your scientist, like you and me, he's using his sense of sight especially, of hearing as and where necessary, and he's using his brain and the ordinary logical intellectual processes, which are all verbal processes, the thinking processes, in order to observe his experiments, note down the results, come to a conclusion. That is the ordinary objective way. There is no question of a transformation of his mode of consciousness. When the question, the subjective question, who am I, is asked, one proceeds philosophically, intellectually, metaphysically, logically, in terms of thought, but one remains conscious in the ordinary worldly mode of consciousness. Logical thinking is conditioned in each person right from the time of his birth by his own constitution to start with, the blueprint that is laid down by the genes and chromosomes and whatever they are and so forth, and by the circumstances around him, his own parents, his friends, his society, the ways of talking, the ways of using your senses. How far do we realize that the way we use our senses is a way which is conditioned by our parents, by those around us, whether I'm a farmer's son and live on a farm, or a scientist's son, or whatever it is, you see, and so forth. It's all conditioned thinking. So this subjective inquiry in terms of what we call brilliant brain work is a conditioned mode of inquiry. There's no question of the transformation of consciousness taking place there. Now, if he who seeks is truly earnest, and if he's also fortunate enough to be told or to wake up through his own personal experience to the fact that one's mode of awareness undergoes changes. Now, one's mode of consciousness is not to be confused with the state of mind in which you are, what we commonly call the state of mind, which is the state of the psyche, not of pure mind. The state of the psyche, your feelings, your emotions, your moods, your whims, all that you go through because of the functioning of the natural drives of the body itself, the electrochemical urges and so on and so on, to your reactions to what people around you are doing and saying, whether they annoy you or trouble you or put you into a horrible temper, that's your, you know, and so forth and so forth. Your mode of consciousness is indefinable. It's one thing which remains a void. Consciousness in itself. You see? And it is your mode of consciousness which is the underlying determining factor of all your thoughts, feelings, etc., as they take shape this way or that way, according to the particular influences at work upon you, the living organism. So you see, the subjective inquiry of the philosopher just produces a whole set of thoughts, of ideas, expressed in words, and the whole lot of thoughts, ideas and words belong to the realm of the finite, the dying. That which comes into being, manifests, passes away, gives place in that process to something else, to something else, to something else. You see? But whether your inquiry proceeds objectively or whether your inquiry proceeds subjectively, if you are fortunate enough to be told, to have this explained to you, and more so, if you are fortunate enough to experience yourself to experience that entry into a state of quiet where you remain fully awake, in fact more intensely awake, but the activity of the sense functions and particularly the activity of the brain churning around thoughts and ideas and talking away inside you, you see, when that quietens down, you experience another mode of awareness. In the early stages, you wake up with a start and say to yourself, "Oh, what's this? This is an extraordinary. I can't explain it. What is this?" You say, and so on and so on. But as you proceed, as you grow that way, with intenser and intenser modes of consciousness, when you come back from them, you experience a remarkable state of wonderment, of happiness, of bliss, of freedom. And so, you wake up to the fact that this change in one's mode of awareness of the same situation, of all the same things, the same people around you, that this changed mode of awareness is of fundamental importance. Now, truth or reality or the ultimate becomes something different. As this transformation of the mode of awareness becomes more and more intense, the point is reached. Now, of course, the two roads have become one road. In fairly early stages, when the talking mechanism of the brain quietens down, quietens down, not suppressed by drugs or by specific yoga practices or any other means, but if it just naturally quietens down without the organism falling asleep, but in actual fact becoming more intensely awake, this is the impossible, almost impossible thing to believe, because your senses are all really wide awake. They really are wide awake, in fact, you see. When this happens, then the two roads have become one road. Whether you start with the objective inquiry or whether you start with the subjective inquiry, soon the two roads become one road. The critical point is this stilling of the constant chatter in the brain. It's the brain that keeps chattering. This is where memory will come in. You see? When that gets still, then in the religious sense, in the yogic sense, in the sense in which the contemplative mystic uses it, you see, you are really awake. Because you become awake to that which transcends duality, multiplicity, all the ambivalence of the psyche, pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, cruelty, kindness. You transcend all reactivity out of oneself, which is a brain reactivity. You transcend all that and are in a state of true unity, not only within yourself, but the unity of the universe, the unitary wholeness of the universe becomes a realized fact through you. This is what the Upanishads meant when they used two phrases in particular. There are four or five which they use. The Atma has been realized. Unfortunately, in translations, and maybe even in the originals in some of the Upanishads, where you do find a verbally careless statement, it is said, you realize the Atma. You never realize the finite can never realize the infinite. As I said a million times, you can't take your teacup and measure the Atlantic. The Atlantic will contain you and your teacup altogether, you see. So it is not you who realize that, it's the Atma that functions freely through you. Or Brahman functions freely through you. So one phrase used is the realization of Atma. The other phrase used is Aham Brahmasmi, which is in practically all instances translated as I am Brahman. Linguistically, that is not incorrect. Factually, I would say quite categorically and unequivocally that in terms of actual fact, it is hopelessly incorrect. It is not that I am Brahman, because the word I refers to the finite organism. It is the symbolical sound to represent one's self-consciousness. It's Brahman who is me. So now, since the two questions which started on two different roads merged into the one question of what is truth, or use any other word you like, actuality or reality or anything, you see, it's merged into one question. If you started off by asking what is ultimate reality, you ended up with the word Brahman. That was the word they chose. If you started with the question, who am I, you ended up with the word Atma. Now, this must be really, the brain can understand this. I think I've put it in terms which are not altogether unintelligible. You can see just how the thing happened. Now, remember the important point in this merging of the two roads into one road and coming to the ultimate fruition. It is a process of denudation of the entire contents of the psyche. A complete denudation of the contents of the psyche. That means not that the contents of the psyche are thrown out of the window. You can't do it. These are all mistakes which people have made, scholars and so-called teachers and whatnot, when they talk. Supposing you think in terms of denuding the whole organism. All right, you throw away your nose, you throw away your ears, you throw away your intestines, you throw away your heart. Like in that tragic poem Casabianca, where was the boy, you know, when the jolly old ship exploded or whatever happened, I forget. Learned it in my school days. Where was he? That's what would happen. Then that's the end of all searching. And the end of all coming to fruition. And dear old Brahman, or Gottheit, or the Absolute, is cheated of coming to some sort of realization through you. You see? So it's not that. The denudation of the psyche means that this quietening down of the entire disturbed activity of the psychophysical organism, the complete quietening down, enables that supreme state of awareness, that supreme mode of awareness, to function unobstructedly through the organism. Now, this is the meaning of the word Atma, of the word Brahman. You may, if you like, talk like this. This is for just linguistic enlightenment. Brahman is the objective term. If Brahman, the infinite object, will say, we will say, you see, if Brahman, the infinite object, were to say, I, that I is the meaning of the word Atma. That is the Atta. Now, nowhere in the whole Pali canon and in the other, as far as I'm aware, either the Mahayana or Tibetan teachings, is it categorically said that there is no such thing as the Atma. That there is no Atma. Because if you did, you cannot escape the fact that this is an annihilationist doctrine. Obviously. You can't escape that. Now, the Buddha himself in the early stages of his ministry, those of you who have sort of read the texts carefully will recall that there is that party of young folk with their girlfriends, their wives, their mistresses and whatnot, you see, in the wood looking for pleasure, and one of the young ladies seem to have skedaddled somewhere and they are searching for her. And the Buddha says, is it not better that you seek the Atta than seek that young lady? He uses that phrase, that term. How could he have denied the Atma or the Atta if he spoke in those terms? There is another wonderful instance, you'll find it in the Majjhima Nikaya, where those three great disciples, Anuruddha, Nanda and Kimila, they are going through a period of intense practice by themselves together in a woodland. And the Buddha approaches that woodland and he is told by the doorkeeper, not doorkeeper but somebody, he says not to disturb them, they are in search of the Atta. And that is accepted as such. Where is the denial of this which cannot be spoken about? But the Buddha was one of the most sensible of all the great spiritual teachers. He knew what was essential and he concentrated upon that. Namely, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. This is the essential task. Never mind all your metaphysical questions and so forth. And in any case, those are unanswerable things. Amongst several questions, there were several questions he just refused to answer at all. But he categorically, unequivocally affirmed there is the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. For, because if there were not this unborn, unbecome, unmade, there'd be no release. I'm slightly expanding the actual words which were used. There would be no release out of bondage to this which is born, become and made. The usual translation is there is no escape from this. Escape is a bad word. I feel pretty certain the Buddha probably did not mean escape. Where can you escape into? You are in the cosmos, whatever you are doing or whatever is happening to you, you can't escape. The entire cosmos is the born, the become, the made. There'd be no release out of the state of bondage to the born, the become, the made. See, it's very important to get a clear understanding of these things. Otherwise, you know, we get the whole thing all wrong and we squander our energies in futile activity, futile things which out of our ignorance we dub meditation, concentration, the discipline and all that sort of thing. There's no discipline in all that. We are footling away. So now, this process of denudation of the psyche becomes a thing of great importance. Remember the Buddhist presentation, analysis of the empirical person. You and I, as we are seen and as we move about in the world and so forth. Form or shape, rupa, and the psychical part is presented in four forms, in its four main aspects: feelings, thoughts or perceptions, feelings, perceptions, our mental patterns which spring up, the whole psychical pattern which springs up from moment to moment and changes during with the passage of time, and vijnana, that activity of the psyche which is discriminative, analytical. Vijnana in Pali is discriminative consciousness. Vijnana in Sanskrit is not that. Vijnana is more of the nature of enlightened awareness, of enlightened consciousness. This is where the two languages differ fairly strongly. But the Pali confinement of vijnana to discriminative consciousness is quite useful, because that is exactly how we do function. We are all the time discriminating this from that. And this is unavoidable and in fact indispensable in order to move and act rightly throughout the day. Otherwise we couldn't survive safely probably for a couple of hours even, if we didn't distinguish a bus from our dearly beloved friend John Bloggs. Isn't that true? So this use is very useful. Now, in terms of body as well as the psychical part, there is this containment by the whole psychophysical organism of all the impressions that come to us. From birth onwards, the impressions that come to us from outside via the senses, and they come to inside to the organism only via the senses. Sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, etc. They may make an impress of a nature in which the nervous system of the body, afferent nerves and efferent nerves and all the rest of it, you know, they send their messages up to the brain, and the brain is the recording angel as well as the misrecording demon. Don't forget that part in us, because it's confused, it's troubled, it doesn't know, you see, and so forth. Now, through the organism and the activity of the organism, these impressions, which at first, in the beginning, are just pure percepts. That is one reason why you find a child just staring like that, unblinkingly. We adults do precisely the same when we come across something quite different or knew something which we didn't know. Haven't you noticed, we look? We stare like that, you see? And we stare like that, especially when, for example, on the TV screen or whatever it is, we see those things which deal with our basic animal drives. anything particularly violent or particularly sensual or sexual or anything like that. You just watch the faces of people around you as they watch modern TV, and you will learn a lot about the people, what is repressed inside, and here is an outlet, you see, and so forth. Because the person is, without his or her knowing it, identifying himself or herself with that sight. You see? So now, all these become our memories. Memories with a firm foothold in the entire psychophysical organism. But the psyche has to be denuded of all this if man is to become truly man, the human, and we have discussed this before, he in whom all evil-mindedness has been completely burned up. Like the burning bush which doesn't get consumed. Moses' burning bush which doesn't get consumed. It's one of the great wonderful mysteries. There are other meanings also to the non-consumption of that burning bush. So you see, memory is one of the great obstructors. Now the memory is not burnt out altogether. The quality of that memory is completely transformed. Because if all your memory is burnt out, as I say, as you know, you can't survive. Even, and certainly in a big city, you couldn't. Our dear Andrew couldn't possibly arrive here safely on his motorbike if all his memories were burnt out like that. But they are utterly transformed. And what is one of the supreme marks of that transformation? Everything of the nature of attachment and aversion is no more present in that memory. That is burnt like that. It is, the burning is a purification, not a destroying. The dross, the psychical dross, unlike material dross, which is burnt out, you get rid of it to get your pure metal, your pure gold. This dross is converted into pure mind, pure intelligence. And with it, you will experience and know for the first time what love in its reality is. In its reality, we don't know what it is, as we are. So now, the Buddha, the Buddhist teaching of anatta is just that. That the body and the psyche are as we are, the body and the psyche are not of the nature of the Atma, the utterly pure, the transcendent, the perfect. Put it another way, Atta is devoid of all the blemishes characterizing shape, form, feelings, thoughts, ideas, conceptions, beliefs, etc., etc., etc. This is the real meaning of anatta. And when you see that, really see it clearly, see it so that in your daily life you cannot possibly forget it. It's always with you. You are aware of it. Then there is liberation and freedom.